The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. We are going back to Napa, to one of the most famous wineries. A winery, you go to Ontario, LCBO, Quebec, BC, wherever. And of course, there's people that listen outside of Canada. My apologies. You will see Stag's Leap Winery all over the place. It is a staple of quality California, certainly Cabernet and other varietals as well. Joining us now, the senior winemaker and general manager, Ludovic Dervin, is joining us. Ludovic, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Let's start here. Anyone who is the senior winemaker and general manager of a place like Stag's Leap, that's an impressive title. You don't get that impressive title without building a resume. I kind of want to start at the beginning of the resume for yourself, sir. I'd love to hear about your early days growing up in Champagne. And where was that first moment when you fell in love with wine and sparkling?
Well, growing up in Champagne, the first answer is it's cold. Yes. Champagne is one of the most northern grape growing regions in the world. And without a doubt, one of the most beautiful wine regions with the most beautiful underground caves. Champagne wines remain the wines of kings and queens and the kings of queens of wines. With all the hardship that a region endured over centuries, it is amazing to see that its name itself became synonymous of celebration. It's a prime example of resilience and how to turn any hardship into an asset. So for me, school, I was not particularly fond of the classic school system. I always got decent grades, but in all honesty, for a long time, I just followed the path of less resistance. And what I mean by that is I was focusing only on what I was good at. So I didn't have to work too hard at it. And for me, I was really good with the scientific field, math, physics, chemistry, biochemistry. So I went to university with the intent to get into specialized studies in biochemistry. But I quickly realized that spending the rest of my life in a lab with a white blouse probably would not be suited for me. So I looked at alternatives and started to meet with a few friends who were studying to take the National Diploma of Enology in Reims. Which is a diploma you actually need to have in France to become an official winemaker. So the idea of a job that encompassed the love and interaction with nature, farming, fermentation science, you know, the artistic creativity and social interactions, seemed like a very interesting proposal to me. So I make some appointments to visit some of the local winemakers in Champagne House to learn about their day-to-day activities. And I was really surprised of the welcoming that I got. You know, these guys were kind of already like rock stars and, you know, making time for just a young student to chat about their job. I was very inspired by that. And after seeing the spark in their eyes while talking about their craft got me totally hooked. That was it for me. I applied for the school and I was lucky enough to get accepted on first trial. They usually only have 26 for up to 400 candidates every year. So I felt very lucky to get in. And, you know, the rest was history. Still doing it 30 years later.
A couple things there. The first is I will tell anyone, when you arrive in Paris, what you immediately need to do is rent a car or take the train an hour and a half east, go to Champagne, get out of Paris immediately and head to Champagne. It's beautiful. The second thing is there's a stereotype of in Champagne or certain areas of France, like Burgundy, where the winemaking is more secret, outsiders are sort of shunned. I love the fact that you had the opposite of this stereotype where you were welcomed as this young student into such a famed wine region as Champagne. That's not the stories I normally hear.
No, it's true. But, You know, they say that people have in the heart the warmth that is missing to their landscape. So,
no, it's great. So then I'm curious, when did you make the jump from Champagne to California, two regions that could not be more different?
Yeah, you know, when I first graduated at the University of Reims with my winemaking diploma, I quickly realized that I was competing locally with other guys that were in the winemaking business for seven generations. You know, my parents were not in the wine business. I fell in love with it. I grew up there. I loved the culture, but I was not in. You know, fighting seven generations is a tough call. So I figured that I needed to do something different. You know, back in the 90s, winemakers were not traveling as much as today. And the concept of international consultants was not as developed as today. But I got an opportunity to participate in an international student exchange program called Erasmus. And it allowed me to go and spend 4 months in Greece to study and participate to the elaboration of wine in a very, I would say, old and traditional way. You know, kind of winemaking that includes the use of feet, candles, and prayers. And it was very eye-opening that what, you know, modern science has brought to winemaking.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic experience for a young single man. And so I continued to travel and went to make wines in California and South Africa after that. And after my first 6 months visit as one of the original harvest interns, you know, maybe only 40 of us back then, that was in 1992. And I really fell in love with the place. You know, everything was there for greatness. First, you had an industry that was blooming around there. You know, you have Silicon Valley pretty close, San Francisco, Telecom Valley, a pool of money that was pouring into California. And, you know, beautiful place to grow grapes and people were eager to succeed and a complete kind of blank card bagged them for creativity. So I had an opportunity to come back to California for another 16 months in 1994. And it's kind of a funny story because at that time I was done with my studies with school and I had to face my military duties with my native country of France. You know, back then, it was still mandatory for all young men to serve for 10 months in a military boot camp. But luck struck again for me, and I was able to join a civilian program called National Cooperation. And it allows a few people every year to be hired by a French company that owns business overseas. And you can go work, obviously, for that company for 16 months instead of going to a military boot camp. You know, the military considered you help for foreign exchange that... It's part of national defense. So that's it. So I was hired by a cognac company, Remy Martin, to work to come work in Sonoma for Piper Sonoma for 16 months. And so I got to make sparkling wine for 16 months there, and it waived my military boot camp time. So while some of my friends at uni in Champaign were crawling in 20-degree weather in French military boot camps, I got to make wine in Northern California and go to Rolling Stone Voodoo Lounge concerts and 49ers football games. So that was not a bad deal.
Okay, we're going to get to all things Stag's Leap. It's an incredible Cabernet. But now we're here. How angry were your friends? You're making sparkling in California instead of doing like getting up early and as you marching and crawling and calisthenics and weights. Your friends must have hated you.
You know, it was love and hate. Some loved the idea that they could come and visit when they were done with the 10 months and follow the footsteps. I helped some of them actually get some jobs in California too. So, and others, of course, were very envious and jealous. Yes.
Yeah. No,
life.
I would be as well. I'm glad you're able to get them some jobs. Okay. We're going to bounce around because now I got other questions and questions about your parents, but let's jump ahead to about 2-3 years ago, July of 2022, you joined as general manager and senior winemaker. What was it about Stag's Leap that drew you there? Because you've gone from a world of sparkling in France and in California, and now you're going to, you know, some of your bigger structured Cabernet. What drew you to Stag's Leap?
Well, the name itself, you know, is synonymous of one of the most original, authentic winery of Napa Valley. It's in the heart of one of the most sought after appellation of Napa Valley that helped put Napa Valley on the map 40 years ago. The Stag's Leap Wine District. There's so much history here. You go back all the way to 1893 when our founding winemaker, Horace Chase, acquired this 240 acres piece of land and produced his first bottle of wine there. The Stag's Leap Winery Estate site is magnificent artwork from Mother Nature. Some breathtaking cliffs are on the background of the winery. And right now, after the heavy rains, if you come to the place, you will see these cliffs turning into gorgeous waterfalls. It's only 1 mile of the main road of Silverado Trail, but some days you feel like you're in the middle of a Hawaiian plantation. It's gorgeous. This is the kind of place you fall in love with really at first sight. And also on a more personal level, Stag's Leap Winery has a following cult for its Petite Syrah. which is a grape varietal I've always loved. And the opportunity to work with that incredible fruit sourcing in the heart of Napa Valley was definitely a calling for me.
From a viticultural standpoint, it's the more wine geeky question. Mm-hmm. What do people need to know about the Stag's Leap appellation in terms of the styles of wines it can produce from there?
Yeah, the styles. I mean, that's why it, you know, some of the wines from that area won the Judgment of Paris in 1976, because it makes really classic old world style wine, a very Bordeaux kind like of wines. Stag's Leap Wine District is the smallest appellation of Napa Valley. Extremely unique location in terms of soil profile and climate. You know, being at the foothill of the Palisade cliffs, the wind and water erosion over the years has created some rhyolite deposits into the soils that mingled with the rich fluvial soil of the Napa River. And over time, it created an alluvial mix that has the perfect balance of silt, clay, and sand, giving a good balance of water retention and drainage that allows varietals like Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, or Petit Sirah to thrive. And from a temperature perspective, the dark cliffs of the Palisade on the east facing slopes accumulate a lot of heat during the day. And that heat is released in the evening, and it creates a temperature chimney effect that pulls in the cold air from the nearby Pacific Ocean. You know, the ocean, it's cold currents coming from the Alaska. So there's a pool of cold air that sits above the water. When the heat rises, it pulls in the cold air inside. Why is it important? Because even in summer, the water is very cold, and this regulates a natural air conditioning effect that allows to cool down the vineyards very early in the day and maintains cool temperature at night. And the cold temperature is critical for the style of wines we want to produce in the Stag's Leap Wine District, as it preserves the natural acidity balance of the grapes. Now, we intend to make wines with bright and fresh fruit notes, a lot of complexity. And to achieve that goal, we need to pay a lot of attention to the sugar-acid balance of the grapes in order to make the best educated decision on when to pick. You know, if the weather stays too hot at night, the grapes will burn their natural acidity and tend to create wines lacking freshness and balance, and delivering a wine style with a lot of overripe, jammy flavors. You know, while such wine could be very plush and underboy young, you know, those jammy, fruity wines, they do not tend to age as gracefully over the years, like, you know, some of the classic Bordeaux and old wine words will. You know, we want to make wine that you can enjoy now, but also that will keep getting better for the next 20 or 30 years. You know, the Stag's Leap Wine District usually delivers wine that are more old world style, with great balance between the richness, the power, the complexity, while retaining a lot of freshness and elegance. Really like some classic Bordeaux blends.
Is that the hardest thing for you as a winemaker, is that balance? Because I heard bright, fresh, and acid, but then with Cabernet, there's always going to be power, but you don't want it to be too jammy. Would that be the hardest thing for you as a winemaker, finding that balance between power and plush versus fresh and acid?
Absolutely. And it's a balance we need to do vintage after vintage. You know, so for us, we're looking at when the green herbaceous flavors fade away, and then the acidity goes from tart to being crisp and refreshing. That's one of the things we track in tasting the grapes in the vineyards. Then we want to start seeing the blue and red and blackberry notes appearing and getting more and more complexity, richness. And we want to catch our grapes before they start turning a little bit overripe and jammy. That way, it's the best way to express your terroir, because if you keep waiting, like there's a tendency right now in California to just wait and wait to get more and more ripeness, more and more tannins. But in a certain way, when you start standardizing your wines and it's becoming more difficult to distinguish between your Coombsville, Rutherford, Oakville, it tends to all go in one direction. And when you think about grapes, there's only one place they all go, which is raisins. So the more you wait, the more they trend to, and there's not a lot of complexity in raisins. And we want to be focused on fresh fruit, crisp acidity, so we can make wine for the longer haul. So, you know, some of these wines that are a little overripe can be very seducive in the early days, but you're kind of losing that sense of terroir to standardize a certain taste and palate. So this is not what we're after. We want, and that window of opportunity I'm talking about when, you get that perfect balance between your fruit complexity, the acidity is ripe on the crisp and refreshing, no tartness, and before it becomes too sugary, plummy. Certain years, you have like 10 days to really make your pick. And some years, you have 3 days. So you really have to spend a lot of time walking the rows and making these decisions and prioritizing, because you also have logistics to manage in the cellar.
You mentioned logistics. When I was doing my research, I read that the 23 vintage was, quote, a logistical nightmare. What happened that year?
You know, every vintage is different. And what happened in 23, there was a long and cool Indian summer, which we kind of love because it gives more time for the vines to develop. Usually your picking windows or opportunity are longer. But when it gets really too cool, things wait and wait. And, you know, getting to that optimum window, it all accumulates to the end. And in 23, both whites and reds were ready at the same time. Usually you start with the reds, with the whites, you know, they peak at a certain time. And when they start phasing out, the reds start coming in. So you have a nice bell curve. You can rotate your tanks. You have your time. You know, you're not doing crazy 16-hour days at the winery. It's easier to manage, which is what we had in 21, what we had in 24. 23 was a completely different animal. You know, we could see the greatness in it, but it was nerve-wracking because everything was a waiting game. Harvest did not start before the first week of September, so we're almost 2 weeks late. The whites were not getting there, and suddenly we're looking at it, it's all going to come as a tsunami at the end, and we might get some rain. Might be like 11, some of the, you know, fruit's going to get damaged by the rain, gets all rot, mildew. So it's that waiting game, but it's like playing poker, you know, it's just like, when are we going to pull the plug? And we picked until November 15th.
The second week of September until November 15th?
Yeah.
Oh,
that was
God.
Super. And everything came at the end. So you have all your interns, everybody's ready, kind of, you know. The tanks have never been so clean that year because we keep cleaning tanks waiting for grapes to come in. And then you have a super compacting, which made the logistics super, super complex. But, you know, we made it through and the results was incredible wines. I mean, the grapes displayed intense color, one of the most colored vintage I've seen. Very complex flavor, but it was challenging, nerve-breaking, I would say. But it's going to turn into a collector's vintage for sure.
Oh, really? Okay.
Wines are going to be absolutely.
I'll keep that in mind for 23. And anyone who's been in your business, there are those years where it is such nerve wracking, as you mentioned. It's like a game of poker playing against Mother Nature. You talked a little bit about the history of Stag's Leap, about how it goes back to the late 19th century. Did you feel any sort of pressure when you took over to continue the tradition of quality, like, you know, taking over such a well-known, famed winery?
Yes, absolutely. Pressure is definitely there because, you know, you don't come to a place like Stag's Leap wanting to change everything. When you come to a place like Stag's Leap Winery to lead the winemaking team, you must first come with a very humble attitude. You need to seek to learn from its history, its people, its ground. Doesn't matter what you've learned all your time. These are just tools, but you have to sharpen these tools to continue your legacy. And Stag's Leap Winery has developed a large pool of very loyal customers. So it is very important to understand what they like about this place and its wines. And yes, it brings a lot of pressure. You're on a don't mess it up program. You know, you don't have like carte blanche to do whatever you want. You gotta, you know, when you go in and lead the car making team at Ferrari, you're not going there to make SUVs, you know, it's just.
That's true. You're not suddenly going there and telling the owners, we're going to make Riesling Mosel style and we're going to rip out. Yeah, we're going to rip out all the Cabernet. By the way, now hopping all the way back, what was your parents' reaction when you told them, I'm not going to be in bioengineering or chemistry, I want to make wine, I want to make sparkling? What was the reaction from family?
Cool.
Yeah.
You know, my parents, they're not from the wine industry, but a lot of distant cousins, friends. So, you know, it's part of the culture in France. So they know you can make a living out of it too. You're not going to be starving, a starving artist for the rest of your life.
Yeah, no, very different reaction than in some other parts of the world. If you say you want to be a winemaker, what was Napa like in the early 90s? Because I mean, now, like so many other areas, everything gets built up. I'm in Toronto and the city is so different now than what it was in the early 90s. The last time I visited Napa was probably back in like 2007, 2008. How different is Napa today versus your early years there?
I mean, 1990s, Napa was definitely more rural than it is today. You know, less high-end resorts and restaurants, less commute traffic. You could pop in any tasting room without an appointment and get a free tasting. Far less millionaires single homes. You could find a gallon of gas for less than a dollar and a good super burrito for $3.99. But all that said, you know, the Napa Valley did a really good job at preserving its wine industry and landscaping through initiatives like the Ag Preserve and sustainability programs like the Napa Green that we are actually part of at Stag's Leap Winery. So still a very enjoyable place to visit at any time of the year.
What is it about Petite Syrah that you love so much? I'll be honest, it's not a grape that gets a lot of attention on this podcast, and you're the first winemaker that I can remember in ages singing its praises. What is it you love so much about Petite Syrah?
Because it deserves far more praise than it gets. You know, when people don't blink at spending $300 or $400 to a good bowl of cab in a steakhouse, you know, try Petite Syrah. You're getting so much bang for your buck with Petite Syrah. You know, Petite Syrah goes all the way back to the 1800s, also in France, as a varietal that was a hybrid between two French grape varietals, the Syrah and the Peloxin. Petite Syrah is called Petite Syrah because the resulting grape looked like Syrah, tasted a lot like Syrah, but on steroids. Much concentration because the berries were little. So thus, Petite Little Syrah. And it's a deceptive name. I have to admit, the Australians maybe were a little bit smarter by calling it Durif, because the French botanist that created Petite Syrah is called François Durif. So when you go to Australia, it's called Durif. And some people in California start using Durif also. But it's also even less known than Petite Syrah anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like the movie Little Big Man. It's little, but it packs so much concentration. And the very simple reason is that when you have small berries with thick skin, you increase your ratio of skin to juice. And since all the good stuff we like from the skins, the color, the flavors, the tannins, well, you just concentrate them. So these wines are just inky. I mean, you could, you know, I like to write with fountain pens, and you could almost refill your fountain pen and write a poem if you're inspired. But I love Petite Syrah. It's very fruity. There's a floral note to it. You find some of that violet characters you have sometimes in good Pinots. There's also the peppery notes of the Syrah. It's a lovely wine. And, you know, we've made Petite Syrah for a long time at Stag's Leap. When Carl Dumani acquired the estate in early 70s, we still have, you know, Petite Syrah going back to the 70s, and these wines still taste outstanding today. You know, so these are wines that can age 30, 40 years. The cork will usually fail before the bottle. So we're also in that kind of looking at recorking some of our old vintage because, you know, the wines are still holding, but the cork won't.
It's a testament to the grape if it's outlasting the cork. Also, for anyone listening, be very careful barrel tasting young Petite Syrah. It is going to pucker. It's going to battle inside your mouth.
No, and it's really the challenge. It's a varietal that needs a lot of air during fermentations because you have to tame these tannins.
Yeah.
But they're round and polished. You have such amazing wines, and it's so fairly priced for the quality. You know, we probably make one of the most expensive Petite Syrah with our Block 5 Naked de Malis, which is named in honor of our founding winemaker, Horace Chase. But that block goes back to 1929 when it was first planted. And it's planted in similar ways they planted in Côte du Rhône, which I mean that there's 17 different varietals planted in that block. And they used a lot of the other varietals as kind of the canary in the mine. They're in France called cépage docteur, because every varietal is sensitive to different disease. So some of these varietals were planted, there's two or three vines only, but they give you an idea of the disease pressure that you might have in your vineyard and what you need to do to treat the rest of the vineyard. So that vineyard we have at Naked de Malis has 17 different varietals co-planted with Petite Syrah. Even if it's over 90% Petite Syrah, there's a little touch. And what they realize in the old days is that by having all these blocks co-planted like this, every single block is so different from the other because they actually pick the whole thing and co-ferment everything. So what we do on that block, we will go the day before picking, knock off any grapes that should not end up into the fermenter. So cleaning pass, if things are too ripe and underripe, and then the picking crew only picks the clean fruit the next day, and we co-ferment the whole thing together. makes a really unique wine you cannot even duplicate.
All right. Well, now if I see it at the LCBO, I got to grab a bottle. I've had your Cabernet. I've not had your Petite Sirah. Now I got to go and find it. You piqued my curiosity. Going back to all things Stag's Leap, I was wondering what is the general portfolio? I'll start with this. What do people need to know about how you would describe the general style of Stag's Leap? And I understand that every vintage, no two vintages are going to be the same. But if you're going to describe what Stag's Leap is all about in terms of philosophy and style, what would it be?
So, I mean, while every vintage is different, we still need to strive on delivering wines of similar personality and style year after year, because there is an expectation from the people who follow our wines. You know, some years you'll have more or less color, some years you'll have more or less acidity, more or less tannins. But by carefully selecting grape growing sites, picking dates, adjusting your crop loads, you can leverage our final blends to best respect the Stag's Leap wine style and personality year after year. You can also adapt the winemaking techniques to enhance or repress certain characteristics of the wine, more or less fermentation heat, more or less, you know, which kind of yeast you use in your fermentation, more or less air during fermentation, the barrels you use, how long it stays in the barrels. There's just a lot of things we can play to adjust. You know, winemakers are a little bit like doctors or musical conductors. You know, like a musical conductor, every year they will get a new team of instruments and players. But if you want to play the Four Seasons, it has to sound the same way Vivaldi intended years ago. And so you're going to fine tune that instrument for 6 months, a year before you play the piece. But at the end, it has to kind of sound the same to the public. So you constantly have to tweak things around. And also like a doctor, you have to keep things healthy and harmonious. So you're dealing with Mother Nature. Sometimes, you know, some vintage will need corrective action. I mean, think about years like 2020, where many people had to battle wildfires. It's a prime example of it. If the vintage has smoke tan, do you want that vintage story and that smoke tan in your wines? No, you don't. So you have to take corrective action. So that said, the style for Stag's Leap Winery, we're going to focus more our grape picking to the southern part, which is a little cooler. So again, we want that fresh acidity. We want to make wine for the long haul. So we're looking at wines with a lot of richness, a lot of complexity, fresh fruit characters, but also a lot of finesse and elegance into the wines.
What's misconceptions? There's misconceptions about California Cabernet. For people that are just getting into it, some people get scared off. They'll hear, oh, it's too sweet, too much sugar, too jammy, too this or that. Now, usually that's because of mass-produced Cabernet from not very good vintage sites spread it all across California and Napa, which is huge. What would you tell people that maybe have a negative perception of Napa Cabernet Sauvignon?
It's not necessarily just a price point or greed. I think, you know, a lot of people have tried also to please certain wine writers. So they tend to standardize a taste towards that kind of pleasing. And it has been definitely a trend to override Cabernet Sauvignon grapes in California in the last couple of decades. I would agree to that. I mean, we're blessed with incredible warm and sunny weather in California. And this blessing can quickly become a curse because you get complacent with it. So you just wait and you extend maturation on the vine to develop these rich tannins and ripe fruit tones. You tend to wait a little bit too long and you're losing that freshness. And then suddenly, if you have to deal with logistics, it's even worse. It compiles think about if you want to make a tomato salad and you bake your tomatoes, you're not going to make a fresh mozzarella salad anymore. It's just you cannot go backwards. So it's good to have maybe a little bit of it on the ripe side, but you want that complexity by having it. Some sites will be better because they still retain the acidity. But again, the more you wait, the more you're going to standardize. And then it becomes really difficult to differentiate your Calistoga from Santa Elena, from Oakville. You know, we're trying to promote terroirs, but to promote terroirs, you got to keep that freshness into your wines.
What's this vintage looking like so far? And I know it's super early. Actually, no. It's too early to answer what this vintage is going to be like. Dumb question by me. I'll go this way. This time of year, you know.
No, actually, you know what? I could answer that question.
Oh, okay,
one
go,
of these vintages is so promising too. You know, 24 start to remind a lot of 21. Because 21 was kind of a nice bell curve, very low yields, and super concentrated wines. And we start seeing kind of a trend that reminds us a lot of 21 right now with our 2024. So very, very happy. And it was a nice logistics, which is nice. We haven't seen that really since 21, actually. So.
And what's this time of year like for you? We're recording this on February 13th. So it's not like you're getting ready to pick anytime soon, clearly. But for a senior winemaker and the general manager, what is this time of year like for you, sir?
So for the winemaking hat, we are working on our blend trials for the 23s or the reds that we need to blend and put together for bottling before July. And then we also do a lot of rackings, and we test our wines to decide if they need more air, less air. So we kind of do the fine tuning on the wine in barrels. And then this is the time of the year where your GM hat takes a lot of space, because you start working on your budgets, on your mid-year reviews, on barrel orders for the following vintage, trying to polish your crystal balls on what your yields are going to be, and what the markets and what your production levels are going to be for the following vintage. So,
what is your success rate of your predictions coming true?
For yields or for...
For yields, yeah.
For yields, it's, you know, I've noticed that the best person to ask for a yield forecast is the guy who waters the plants, the vines,
right?
Because they're outside all the time. They don't need any tools, any AI, and they're usually spot on.
Wait a minute. Don't tell me AI is involved in winemaking.
Of course it is. You know, and it's a great tool. Again, it's like everything else. It's what you do with it.
Right.
You know, it's a scary proposal. I agree in many, many ways. But, you know, what it can do to help the algorithm on the weather forecast, on pressure disease forecast, it's actually pretty darn good. You know, we do a lot of imagery in the vineyards to try to see also early signs of pressure disease. And so the data we can collect and analyze is actually, it's pretty amazing tool.
Okay. You know what? Now, that sounds way better. You got to remember, I was the last of my friends to have a BlackBerry. I'm a dummy when it comes to technology. AI scares me, but if it can help with disease pressure, with climate, I mean, 100%, then I'm all for AI if it helps you in your winemaking process.
Absolutely.
Last question for you. For people traveling to Napa, what advice would you give? A lot of people here that listen are Canadians. Eventually, they're going to want to be traveling and get out of here. I mean, right now I'm looking at a ton of snow, the opposite of what you're looking at. But what advice would you give someone first timer coming to Napa?
So I would say try to pick the time less traveled and less busy, because you will have more time and attention when you visit wineries. The people waiting on you or giving you tours are not rushing from one table to the next, but they have a little more time for you. So it's always nice to, it's always nice to see the harvest activities, but there's beauties to see in Napa all the time. Like right now, I said we have these flash floods and these flash waterfalls appearing on the background. It's all green. Pretty soon, you're going to see the mustards out in the fields. So, early spring is a great time. Late fall is a great time. Plan ahead, because it's getting really busy. So make sure, you know, it's always disappointing when you think you're going to just walk into a tasting room and make sure that they don't request appointments. You know, again, the visitation is a blessing and a curse, because at some point, you know, we have to stop doing free tastings because it's just too many people to manage.
Yeah.
It gets out of control. So, make sure to do your research and plan your week ahead. Just that will make a much better experience.
And for anyone listening, go on a Wednesday. Go on a Wednesday right when they open. Try to avoid Saturday if you can. Ludovic, I really appreciate the time. I got about 1 minute left. Is there a bottle you are waiting for, saving for, either for the weekend, a birthday, if the 49ers eventually win a Super Bowl? Like, is there a bottle? and you got close. Hopefully Brock Purdy gets a fair deal. Is there a bottle that you've been eyeing that you can't wait to open?
There's one that I probably have waited too long, which is a 1970 Cheval Blanc.
What are you waiting for? What were you waiting for?
I know. And I am not saving for a special occasion, but one day the occasion will be there. And that's one I'm looking forward to open, actually.
I think the occasion should be a Tuesday. Ludovic, really appreciate you taking the time. Again, Stag's Leap has been around for ages and just one of these sort of symbols of consistent and fresh California Cabernet. Now I can't wait to try one of the Petite Syrahs. Thank you so much for being on the pod today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Mac Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Mac Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.